G'day. Thanks for joining us in this Broadway Spotlight edition of The Stages podcast, a Spotlight replay brought to you by Academy Travel, a leading specialist in small group cultural tours. And we've got exciting news for you. Join me in January 2024 as Academy Travel takes us to the city that never sleeps on an immersive and jam-packed adventure into theatre, opera, jazz and cabaret. A 10-day tour in which we will sample the best of Broadway, the Metropolitan Opera and jazz in Brooklyn, alongside a host of cultural experiences at museums and galleries populating the Big Apple. As your stage's host, I'll be leading the tour, accompanying participants in an exciting array of activities that are bound to delight, thrill, and engage the eager theatre fan. What can be better than diving into arts and culture in the greatest city in the world, the Big Apple, the city that never sleeps? Find further information at the Academy Travel website, academytravel.com.au, and search Theatre in New York Best of Broadway Tour. To whet the appetite, Stages will be visiting conversations with Australian artists who conquered the Great White Way in a series of Broadway Spotlight episodes, brought to you by Academy Travel. Amelia Cormack is presently playing on Broadway in the Tony Award-winning Best Musical, Hadestown, a production we'll be seeing on the New York Broadway Theatre Tour in January 2024. Stages spoke with Amelia in November 2022. She reflected on her move to the States, the exciting musical theatre she has been able to traverse, and a dream come true, her Broadway debut. All aboard!
The last time I saw you was at Thunder Down Under or whatever that
time. Oh, Magic Mike.
Yeah. Yes.
That's right. Yes. Oh, my gosh. That was such a blast from the past. I ran into so many people that I hadn't seen in a very, very long time, including an ex-boyfriend, which was a lovely surprise. It wasn't a bad thing, but it was like, oh, it was just crazy. Like, I hadn't seen so many of those people since the Priscilla days, because a lot of them were Priscilla crew. So it was like, oh my God.
So. What I found most impressive about that show, Magic Mike, was the purpose-built Spiegel tent.
Yeah.
Wasn't it amazing?
It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
Absolutely gorgeous.
Have you ever performed in a Spiegel tent?
I haven't. I know a lot of people that have, obviously, as we both do, but I've never done it. I would like to. I'd like to one day, but yeah.
Yeah, they're all over the world. I mean, when they were first mentioned, I thought there was only one Spiegel tent and it just travelled the world. Yeah. But obviously.
I think that was the original idea, but then they built a whole bunch more because it was so popular.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah. Well, hello, Amelia Cormack, on the other side of the world in another time zone.
Hi.
You're in New York City, of course. Does that time difference make it a challenge to connect with family and friends back in Australia?
It sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Most of the time it's actually okay, because as we get into our afternoon, you guys are just waking up. So it's actually, and especially being on a show schedule, it's nice to kind of go before I go into work then I can call people just as they're waking up. So it's kind of, you know, I've been living away, you know, I had 2 years in London and then I've been here in New York for 9 years. So it's kind of become par for the course. Although I do have a little formula, depending on which time zone it is. At the moment, I think we're 15 hours behind. So I just add 3 and reverse it.
Yeah, that works. That works.
Yeah.
And to the listener, just so you know, it's 5 a.m. In Sydney while I'm talking to you.
I mean, God bless you. God bless you for being willing to get up at that hideous hour just to talk to me.
Oh, no, you've got an 8-show week, so it's important to fit in with you.
It's, living that dream.
Well, living it up, so to speak.
Yes, indeed.
makes the summer sunshine bright? That's right, Persephone. Who makes the fruit of the vine get ripe?
Persephone!
That's me. Who makes the flowers bloom again in spite of the man?
You do!
Who's doing the best she can? Persephone, that's...
Because, of course, chatting to you for a whole range of things, but most particularly because you recently made your Broadway debut in the musical Hadestown. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you.
And it was a Broadway debut that came along at, can we say your age?
Of course. Yeah. I am 42.
That's dreams do come true.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Obviously it's been a lifelong held goal of yours to perform on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Did you ever think it was going to happen?
That's a really interesting question. I felt like it was just a matter of time, and I had a lot of people buoying me up. But along my journey, it's very much been just, I'm just going to keep putting one foot in front of the other. And I definitely had lofty goals and ambitions for what I wanted, but it wasn't, it's weird now that I think about it. It was kind of like, well, that's the end goal. It feels like it's the natural progression of things, and it's just a question of time. But obviously I put a lot of hard work in and didn't give up on that. But it's, you know, I've been in New York for 9 years, and this is the first show that I've done in New York, let alone on Broadway at all, because I've done a lot of touring and regional work here in the States. And it's definitely the end goal, but there's this weird disconnect sometimes between when something is a dream, it's away, it's far away, it's over there. You can keep fantasizing about it. And then when it becomes real, it's like, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing, but it's also terrifying because when it's over there, it gets to be just over there. It's not real yet. And then when it becomes real, you have a whole lot of like, well, can I match up to this crazy expectation I've created of this thing that we all, you know, drive and work and strive for? And it is incredible and wonderful. And my God, Hadestown is such a gift of a show. And I am so deeply humbled and grateful to be in such a beautiful show that's a hit. But yeah, it's definitely a mixed bag of emotions, that's for sure.
Well, you're a good 15 years younger than me. And when I was growing up, yeah, it just seemed such an alien achievement to sort of perform on Broadway. But I suppose someone of your age, you're growing up and you're seeing people like Tony Collette appear on Broadway, and Hugh Jackman and winning Tony Awards, and Tim Wright and Carmel Dean starting to pave their way in New York City. So that must buoy you and give you hope that, yes, it is within reach.
Oh, it's extraordinary. I feel so lucky to have come at a time. And the Australia performing community here in New York is a truly extraordinary thing. We are family. And especially those of us that stayed through the pandemic, we watching the way that everyone showed up for each other is truly, and, you know, I had wonderful people like Kay Tuckerman who just enveloped me, took me under her wing, and I consider my sister. She's been such an extraordinary support to me. And, you know, Lexi Fishman from my Whopper days is here, and a bunch of other people. And it is watching us make our mark. I will say, and I think one of my most precious memories, Eddie Perfect asked me and David Harris to come to a workshop reading of Beetlejuice. And the day that they did this reading, Kerry Butler had laryngitis, so she couldn't sing. And I'm watching Eddie, that I know from the Whopper circle because he graduated the year before I got there. And I'm watching someone that did the same thing that I did sing for this Broadway star that I grew up absolutely idolizing and adoring. And I messaged him afterwards and I just said, it was at a particularly low point where I'd been through a bunch of auditions and just wasn't booking for months on end. And I just was like, you just gave me so much inspiration. And to watch someone that comes from where we come from be in this room with these luminaries, and singing. I will treasure that memory forever. And I think it's something that really buoyed me and kept me going at a time that was really hard.
Yeah, thank you for sharing a few more names there, you know, Beautiful Kay and Eddie and Alexis and David. And yes, as soon as you open that that lid, there are so many Australians making their way in New York and on Broadway. And we can't forget, you know, Tony Sheldon's glorious story through Priscilla.
Of course. And also Tim Minchin, I mean, with Matilda, like it just, I feel like I'm truly benefiting and being here in this kind of golden age where Australians are really making their mark here. And it makes me really, really proud, really proud. And I think it also acknowledges the fact that I am so grateful for the theatre education I had in Australia. I think we are taught to work hard and never take anything for granted because it is so competitive and there are so few jobs. And I was so fortunate to have Tony as a dear friend and mentor from the end of my second year of WAPA. He directed us in a production of Shark Brothers Alive and Well and Living in Paris. And he and I just instantly bonded. And then, of course, we did Priscilla together in Australia. And, you know, I got to watch him here on Broadway in the show. And he's just been such a constant source of inspiration for me and just a model of how to be a professional in this industry. Just grace and kindness and humility. And every single night, I always talk about we would get on the bus during MacArthur Park in Priscilla and watching him or listening to him sing the beginning of that song at that moment in that show, it was always one of the most beautiful moments I've seen on a stage. So I feel very grateful to have had those people around me. And, you know, Genevieve Lemon and Jackie Weaver, my God, I mean, looking at Jackie's trajectory, Jackie's been such an inspiration to me as well. I mean, she broke Hollywood in, you know, at a much later stage in her life than most people do. And, you know, like her and Caroline O'Connor is another one as well that, you know, her Broadway story, I'm surrounded by inspirations of this thing doesn't happen overnight. People work for decades to make this happen. And it's interesting when I speak to younger people, I really feel for young people coming up as teenagers and in their 20s with social media and TikTok and all these things, I feel like they're shown this instant model of fame that it has to happen instantly. And one of the things whenever I go to schools or to give masterclasses or anything like that is I always say to them, I said, there are some of us like me who we're never going to be the ingenue or we're never going to be the romantic lead. So our stuff's coming later in our life. And if you want this, you have to be prepared for the fact that it is going to take time. Some people, it's instant, but then it doesn't last. When it's instant, it doesn't last. So, I look at those people and those careers, and that's what I aspire to, really.
Yeah, it's an occupation that requires a lot of perseverance, a lot of resilience, and a lot of luck.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, you can't put your finger on luck. It's just
no.
You a fatalist that it's in our orbit that things will happen or not?
It's interesting. I it's funny that you mentioned that. So I remember when for people that may not be aware, I moved to London in 2011 and I was there for 2 weeks and I got a phone call from the producers of Priscilla asking if I wanted to rejoin the company for the last 3 months of the run on the West End. Now, I'd gone to London kind of waiting for my green card to come through. I wasn't planning on being there very long. I didn't even know if I was good enough to work internationally. It was purely I don't really want to be in Sydney anymore. So I'm just going to go there and just work in a bar and wait for my green card. And I remember coming home at one point after that had happened and I was saying to a friend of mine, I said, I just feel so lucky that that call came. And she said, luck had nothing to do with it. She said, you put yourself in the place for that to happen. And I think I really like that because while there is a certain measure of luck, there's also, I took the risk and I often feel like sometimes, and I'm not a religious person, but I'm so spiritual. I say sometimes you have to show the universe that you're willing to take a risk. And I have been so very fortunate and privileged in my life that that risk has paid off a number of times. But it's taken a lot of having faith that, and especially, you know, like I was saying, in that year, and I think it was 2018, I had 8 months of back-to-back auditions where I got down to the last round or the second last round. And it was really disheartening and really, really hard. And it was like, and in fact, here's an interesting story. The last audition at the end of that 8 months was for Hadestown on Broadway, for the original Broadway company. And it kind of broke me a little bit when I didn't book it, because I'd cancelled a gig, a Christmas gig that I usually get, I'd pulled out of, and, you know, taken that risk. And it was the first time that I ever went, oh, am I sure that I want to do this? And it's so, I mean, the beautiful irony and circle of life that I am now in that show. It's, yeah. And there's a whole other story about being in the show with Lilias, which we might get into at a later point. But it's so, there is some measure of luck. There's also a lot of privilege of me having the financial support and place that I am able to take those risks and do that, which obviously I know there are so many that are not able. And part of my journey on Broadway, I feel like I am carrying the hopes and dreams of so many people on my shoulders every moment that I step out on that stage, for the people that gave up, for the people that did not have the opportunities that I did. And I take that responsibility very, very sacredly and seriously.
Yeah. Lilias White is certainly a dot point that I wanted to talk to you about in this conversation. You're certainly surrounded by the best in the Broadway cast of Hadestown. It's led by Joelle Blackman as Persephone, Grammy Award winner Reeve Carney as Orpheus, Tony Award nominee Patrick Page as Hades, two-time Tony Award nominee Eva Noblezada as Eurydice, and, of course, Tony Award winner Lilias White. What is your role in the show?
So I play... I play one of three fates. I often joke with people that I'm basically doing what I did in Priscilla, but Mean Girls. Because once again, I am a part of a trio. And it's amazing. So the fates are, we know what's going to happen. And the show very closely models itself on the Greek myth. For those that don't know the show, it's the Orpheus and Eurydice story, but steampunk. So we are the fates that we watch what happens, and we have a say, we have a comment on the action, and we taunt and tease the unlucky souls that are, and we even the gods as well, we even play with the gods and their emotions and guide them various places. So it's a very, very, very fun part to play. I have a lot of, I'm very mischievous. My fate is very gleeful and mischievous in what she's doing. So
So working alongside Lilias White, you've done that before, haven't you?
I have, in 2010 in Fame, yeah.
In Australia,
yep. Yep, she replaced Darlene Love as the headmistress. I should remember the part. I can't remember the name of that role. But, yes, she replaced
Lynch.
And we did this. That's it.
No, Miss Lynch is Grease.
Oh, there we go.
I'm just trying to think of headmistresses. Yeah,
yeah. I can't remember her name, but she has that glorious song, "These Are My Children." Mm. And it was Lilias and Josie Lane and I joined for the Sydney season in 2010.
So it was an old home week, I guess, stepping into the Broadway cast. Because did she join around the same time? Because I believe she was replacing Andre de Shields, who won the Tony Award.
Well, she actually, T. Oliver, who had been in the show already, had replaced Andre and then for a period of time, and then Lilias replaced T.
Right.
She her first performance was the 13th of September and mine was the 23rd of September. So, yeah.
So it must be great to be under the wing of someone like her that you've already got a relationship with. And it was such a phenomenal Broadway, has had such a phenomenal Broadway career.
Yeah, she's such a light. We actually became very, very close in 2010 in Fame. I had a very tough time on that show. And I had some vocal issues that then made me question my whole sense of self. And she and I just became really close, and because we joined at the same time, and I would go and sit in her dressing room and we'd talk about various things and go out for lunches and just how I just connected. And so, and we'd stayed in touch a little bit when I came to visit her in New York, and I'd seen her a couple of times, but we hadn't seen each other in a really long time. And then when I walked in the building on my first day of rehearsal and she was there, and I dropped my mask and I looked at her, and she just wrapped her arms around me and we both started crying. And I may get a little bit emotional as I tell this story, because as I was saying before, with the full circle moments, to come full circle in this way from one of the darkest times of my life to then the pinnacle so far with this woman that was such a shining light for me. And she was like, I'm so happy you're here, I'm so proud of you. And every night we're on stage on that show together, she comes in our bows, she comes and grabs my hand and squeezes it, and it's amazing. Again, to come back to your fatalism thing, there's some would argue that was a meant to be moment, but the healing that has come out of that for me, to come full circle in that way with someone who's such a legend, and also watching her to perform this role, which she just is so wonderful in this role. And if anyone happens to find themselves in New York, you must see her in this role. It's truly extraordinary. Girl, come on in from the cold on the railroad line. Young girl looking for something to eat, and brother, thus begins the tale of Orpheus and Eurydice.
Amelia, you've experienced a huge number of opening nights, but Broadway must be pretty special. Tell us about your opening night on Broadway. What was that like?
It was a blur. It was amazing. So basically I'd come off a year on the road with Come From Away, and I went straight from that into Hadestown, and I had a very brief window for rehearsal. I think it was 2.5 weeks. I literally, my last day on Come From Away was the 4th of September, and my first day on Hadestown was the 6th. So it was very, very quick. The day itself, we had my put in, which is like my dress rehearsal with the whole cast on the Friday afternoon. And then I went into the show that night. And I am very fortunate to have a moment captured on, someone took a photo, our incredible dance captain, Tara Jackson, stood next to me after we'd done some spacing stuff, and she whispered in my ear. If you go on my Instagram, you can see the photo. And she said, I want you to just take a moment and breathe and look at where you are. Sorry, I might get a little emotional. And the fact that she took that time to say to me, stop and look, look at what you did. Look at where you got yourself and look at where you are. Whatever happens tonight, you did this. And this cast were so incredibly supportive and welcoming and wonderful. So then to have that, and then to have my dad, who'd flown all the way from Australia, in the audience. Kay was in the audience, my brother and his wife were in, my aunt. Like, I had so many family members and people there. It's very, very difficult to put into words, having your dad see you finally do the thing that you left home to do. It's, yeah, it still chokes me up a little bit. I still feel like there's moments where I'm not really sure what I'm doing there. Like, you know, like, that is it really real? This is my job. I go to Broadway and then I come home. Yeah, it's still a surreal feeling to this day. So, and I think I've just finished my fourth full week, so it's still very new. But yeah, I will eternally be grateful to the secret photographer and to Tara as well for doing that. And there was a lot of tears. There was a lot of tears that day, that's for sure. But again, coming back to what I was saying before, you know, again, I felt my grandparents with me. I felt so many people who didn't think they could or never tried because they didn't, you know, that's what I felt on that day as well. You know, the people that have paved the way, past and present, to get me to this point, that was very, it was very, very palpable to me.
There's also, I guess, the enormity of those stage giants, Broadway giants, who have graced the stage of the Walter Kerr Theatre for decades before you.
I mean, Bruce Springsteen was on our stage. Bruce Springsteen did his one-man show, which I watched on Netflix and was completely overawed and amazed by. And yeah, so many wonderful people. In fact, Tony Sheldon did Amelie in that theater as well. And I saw Tony Sheldon in Amelie. So we were comparing notes on dressing rooms.
Well, that's an interesting point too, you know, because those Broadway theaters are very intimate out front. What's it like backstage? Do you have the dressing room sizes that you have in Australia? Or
It is teeny, tiny. People would be very, very surprised to see how very little space there is. But, you know, a lot of these theaters are really old. And as we say, space is at a premium in New York. And I mean, that New York theaters don't even have theater foyers where you go and have a drink. That's why I always say to people, if you're coming to a show in New York, you do not need to line up to get in. You can get there literally 5 minutes before the start time, and then you will walk straight in and straight to your seat. So don't go and get a drink somewhere nearby and then come to the theater at the last possible minute. It's very, very different to back home. But yeah, they don't, like, you literally walk straight through the doors to your seat and then you leave at the end, right up onto the street. So they are very small, intimate places, but again, just steeped in so much history. There's a wonderful tradition that they have here in America. I'm trying to remember if we did it in London. We might have done it too, which is the ghost light. And every theater, once it goes dark, once everyone's left, will have a light bulb and on a stand, a light in the center of the stage that is on all night while we're all away. And it's called the ghost light. And it's the idea, some would say it's the idea of keeping the ghost company. Some would say it's the idea of keeping them away. You know, I think, I'm sure there's an amazing historical story that I am forgetting right now about the tradition of it, but I love that that's a tradition, you know, and it's regional, like, as I said, regional houses everywhere. Every theater will have a ghost light on the stage.
Well, I remember during COVID when theatres shut down, the ghost light was certainly an image that a lot of people had on their social media and would keep pushing just to ensure that people returned to theatres.
Yeah.
Being part of Hadestown must also be a win for girl power. It's the first time in over a decade that a woman has been the solo author of a musical, writing the music, lyrics and book. And it's the fourth time in Broadway history that a woman has accomplished this creative feat. It also marks the first time in Broadway history that a show's female composer and female director both won Tony Awards for their work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible. And you know, I was so fortunate in my final audition to have Rachel in the room, and I've auditioned for her. I auditioned for the for her shows. I auditioned twice for the Great Comet of Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812, which I loved that show, and actually was working merchandise on, which is a whole other story. and then as this was the second audition for Hadestown. Then I finally booked it, and Aeneas came in and saw the show there. She's just kind, both of them kind, supportive, wonderful women. And yeah, to see the mark that women are having and women-led productions, it's really exciting, and it's really great. And I'm so thrilled that I get to do a show like this and get to do one of Rachel's shows, because I love her vision, and I love Natasha Pierre was such a wonderful show. And I loved being able, one of the joys of working merch is you get to watch shows for free. Well, you get paid to watch shows. And just what they did with the staging, what they did with there were actor musicians in that as well. It was just a glorious, glorious show. And this one I had actually seen before. I went and saw it before I rejoined Come From Away after the pandemic, and I just wept at the staging of it and the simplicity and the raw gut punch emotion of it. And this score is just so rich and wonderful and vibrant and smoky, and then just the vocals on that stage. I am inspired every day.
Do you have a routine, Amelia, when you arrive at the theatre?
Yes. So I am a bit of an early bird. I like getting there early. I usually will give, because I like to get there early so I can sit, which is weird. As some people, it's also here in America, we don't have an hour call, we have a half hour call, and there's no company warm up. Which I found very strange, and still to this day, it's very different being on stage with people you haven't seen in the building yet. But I will get there an hour and 15 minutes before the show. I have a little travel kettle. I'll boil my water, make my throat coat tea with some honey. And then I will kind of I'll put on a podcast and slowly start to get ready. And then the other girls in the dressing room will come in So here in America as well, they do particular wig times. If you are wearing a wig in a show, it's all timed out to very specific times. But we're very fortunate with this as the Fates. We wear these kind of turban hats that we don't, that I don't have to wear a wig, which is great, which means I just get to take my time and, you know, perch it, you know, get ready when I'm ready, which is really nice and not always the case. They're kind of my rituals. I usually now, because we don't have a company warm-up, I will do my warm-ups at home before I leave. And because I'm Fate One, so I'm singing in the rafters a little bit, and it's all very high, nasty, pingy. So, and I usually say it takes me about 6 weeks to really sing a role into my voice. And so I'm still finding what's my 8 shows a week standard, you know, where do I need to be in order to make sure that I deliver the same show 8 times a week. So it always takes a little while to, because of course I am me and I will give you everything I have, but that's not maintainable 8 shows a week. So you know, just finding those little things.
I get to New York a bit to have my Broadway fix, and I guarantee that at every show I attend, there's a standing ovation. Now, the audience are wanting to applaud what they have just seen, but from your perspective, has that become an expectation of Broadway audiences, a ritual, or are they just standing up because they have to stretch their legs because the seats are so small?
I think American audiences are very effusive. I think they just love it. They're so happy to be there. There are some things that I've been to that I went, well, that absolutely did not deserve a standing ovation. So I won't give one. I'm very Australian about it. It's like, did it earn it? Yes. If it did, then I'm on my feet. If not, then I'm not. But they also, the other thing to remember is the majority of Broadway audiences are actually tourists. So they're people that, have come from outside of New York who are just thrilled to be there. And I think that's the thing that a lot of people don't necessarily realize is that, and one of the things that made the pandemic so hard and the uncertainty around it is because it's the people from out of town that come, that spend the big bucks, that, you know, stay at the hotels, that eat at the restaurants, you know. So yeah, they definitely love a standing ovation here. I like for a piece to earn it a little more personally, but also it's wonderful to be on that stage and you get that every night. And I definitely think this show earns it 100%. I mean, the performances, the story, the orchestra, like all of it, it absolutely deserves it. But there's definitely been certain things that I were kind of like, I don't know about that.
Are you enjoying the stage door culture? Because audiences also love to flock at stage door, don't they? And
they do.
And greet the actors as they leave.
It's really hard post-COVID. It's really hard because we're not actually allowed to. I mean, some theatres have relaxed their policies on it. I still tend to be very cautious because theatre is on such a knife's edge at any moment. Here in America, if someone tests positive, they're out of the building for 10 days, which then takes coverage from, you know, if something else happens. So I still am being very, very cautious. I'm on the subway, I'm wearing a mask. I try not to eat indoors if I can avoid it. And unfortunately, that means when we look out and a lot of people are unmasked in a theatre, I just can't be, you know, being up close with the public as much as I would normally love to. And here in America, one of the bigger tragedies is that here it's very commonplace to pre-COVID to give backstage tours. Like if I was in, say, when I was on the road with Flame Is, if someone had a friend, say, oh, I have a friend who's at the show, and I would always very happily give them a backstage tour because it's such an amazing thing. And in Australia, it's very, even pre-COVID, it was a very, you know, you had to ask and get special permission and all that. So I was always very happy to do it. And it is hard because you can see, especially these throngs of kids who've come all this way and they just want to say hi. And it's, you know, I still just feel a little bit cautious about that. But pre-COVID, absolutely, I loved it when I had toured before and it happened. So yeah, it's finding that balance between, and I will say though, if anyone reaches out to me on social media, I'm absolutely always happy to, you know, to respond and interact. And I think that's become the way that I feel the most comfortable interacting. But I know for a lot of my friends who grew up here and coming to Broadway shows and coming to regional shows, they still have their signed program from when they went to see shows when they were kids. And I spoke to a friend's girlfriend who's also herself a performer. And grew up in New Jersey, and she would ride the bus in and she saw Rent like upwards of maybe 50 times as a teenager. And she knew the cast and she had things signed, and they had a little club of people that would see the show. And what's been really fun over this weekend though with Halloween is we've had people dressed as characters from the show in the front rows, and that's been really, really fun. Really fun.
Well, Amelia, let's rewind back to Amelia as a little girl.
Yeah.
When did your fascination and passion for musical theatre start?
I loved music, everything. I was so fortunate to grow up with a mother and father for whom music was paramount. My mum played piano, my dad played trumpet, both of them not at a professional level, but my mum dabbled and kind of taught piano a little bit. But mum would sit us, by those days, a record player, would sit us by the record player, and she would make up her own stories to great classical works. So, for example, Beethoven's Ninth was the story of the Wizard on the Mountain. Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor was the Lion and the Kangaroo. And so storytelling was all. We would go to opera and symphony in the park every year. And then from the age of five, my parents would have Sydney Symphony subscriptions, and I was taken to the symphony from the age of five at the opera house. But my dad had always, and both of them had always loved musicals. My mum, I think, even became friends. Speaking of stage door moments, I think she became friends with one of the cast members of Chorus Line. She and my aunt went to see it a number of times. But my dad grew up with Rodgers and Hammerstein, and he would often, he would sing that, My Little Girl, Pink and White from Carousel. And then I think my first musical was 42nd Street at Her Majesty's Theatre when I was 9 years old. And my mum took me and a bunch of my friends to go and see that. And I remember just kind of loving it. But it was interesting. I just kind of loved all of it. I loved all of it. And what is amazing is that theatre would go on to be my professional theatre debut, because it's where I did Joseph when I was 13. So again, these cyclical moments, I'm just actually, as I tell the story, I'm like, oh my gosh, this has happened a number of times in my life. when I was in high school, I would do everything, because I played violin and piano. So I would have piano lessons. I would play in the orchestra. I would sing in the choir. I would do the plays. I would do the music. I used to call myself a stage addict. Because if it was involved a stage, I just wanted to do it. When I did my final exams from AHSC, my beautiful singing teacher, Kristen Cornwall, who had trained me classically and then went, here's some jazz, here's some music theatre. And I remember going to her and saying, what do I do? Do I be a jazz singer, an opera singer, or a music theatre singer? Because I loved all of them. And to her credit, she said, well, I don't know. You've got to work that out for yourself. And so then I went to Sydney University, and I ended up doing musicals with SUDS, with the Drama Society, with a bunch of other very well-known now fantastic people. And then I was in the Renaissance Players, which was a medieval music group. And then I was also in a pub band doing jazz and blues. And it was through that my time at university before I went to WAPA that I figured out, oh, I really like belting. And at that time, I liked going out to the pub a little too much. I was like, well, I don't think I can be an opera singer. So that's how I kind of fell on music theater. And then I auditioned for WAPA and got in on my first go, and the rest is history. But I think for me, what I love about music theater is really fun, intense singing, but it's the storytelling. I actually say to people, as a singer, I'm actually an actor first, because it's all about the story. And when I discovered Sondheim as a teenager, my world completely changed. I think that's when the germ of the New York idea really, that, because I had loved Andrew Lloyd Webber and Les Mis and, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein, I enjoyed it. Didn't move me as much. And then I found Sondheim and I went, oh, this is what I like.
Your music education sounds like then that it was informed by many eclectic styles, mm-hmm. which also must come in handy for musical theatre, because a lot of musicals are told in different styles, whether it be mm-hmm. rock opera or legitimate singing as per Rodgers and Hammerstein, or the pop singing that you did in Priscilla.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had when you look at what I've done here in America alone, it's this very mixed bag. You know, I went from Kinky Boots to Les Mis to Come From Away to Hadestown, and with some regional work in between that I've done a number of different styles. I have yet to do a really legit, what we call legit musical, like I've never done a Rodgers and Hammerstein. But I do tend to work more in a contemporary setting. But yeah, it definitely, definitely comes in handy. And that's why I credit Kristen as that first singing teacher. I am a firm believer in, if you because I sometimes when I was actually when you and I met Peter back in at McDonald College when I was teaching there, I sometimes think young voices get pigeonholed way too early. And so with the classical kids, I would give them more contemporary repertoire. And then with the contemporary kids, I would actually give them classical repertoire, because I think if and obviously certain voices are suited to certain things, and that will make itself clear. But there is such merit to all the different, you learn different things from different techniques. And I think that has what has stood me in such good stead, was that I was never told what to sing. So I just went, well, I'll just do all of it. And I think that was the beauty of growing up with the many diverse different styles. I think also I've always been a mimic as a kid. And so I would just impersonate who I heard. And I think a lot of that's also where a lot of that comes in, you know, that I grew up listening to people like Bette Midler and Barbara Streisand and even like Melissa Etheridge, and hearing all these different vocal techniques and just having a go. yeah.
The American performing folk have regional touring and national tours available to them. That's a big thing over there, which obviously we don't have in Australia because of the size of the country. But it obviously helps to have a few regional credits on your CV before breaking into Broadway.
Yeah. You know, people often think that off-Broadway is the next best thing to Broadway, but it's actually, in fact, the tours. You know, and to be on a first national tour like I was for the first year of Kinky Boots, and Come From Away was a first national tour. Even Les Mis, even though obviously it wasn't the first touring production of Les Mis, for this production, it was the first national tour for this particular production. They are very, very highly regarded. And, you know, when I would say to people back in New York that I've done three tours, they'd be like, oh, wow, you know. Because that's how a lot of people will experience Broadway shows, is that especially if you live in the middle, you're seeing the touring production. And they are, you know, some of the productions have been pared down to accommodate better ease of travel, because, you know, there are certain things that you just can't travel, especially if you have automation elements. But no, the regional work, and it's... what I say to a lot of people who move here is, like, you want to get those regional credits because you want to show the casting directors that you can work here. And that's the thing. The more of those regional credits that you acquire, the more hireable you are, the closer it gets you to that end goal. And especially as immigrants, being able to see that you can work in an American environment is really crucial to whether you're going to be hireable further on. It's also a really good place to try out things and try. And there are certain roles that I would never play in New York. So, for example, there's a beautiful theatre company out in Montana that I've worked with a number of times. In fact, they gave me my first job. Called Alpine Theatre Project, and I got to play Regina in Rock of Ages, which is a role that I would never play here in New York, because she doubles as one of the pole dancers. And while I'd love to have a go on a pole, it's not a strong suit of mine. I got to do Vicky in that same season. I got to do Vicky in Full Monty as well. We did them in rep. Which means you do one show one night, another show another night. And then we also had Man of La Mancha that was on a third night, and they'd alternate, which is an amazing experience. Challenging, but amazing. That's why. And it's great to, especially for me now at this point in my career here in America, I also would ring them in Montana whenever I didn't have a job and say, hey, what are you doing over the summer? Or what are you doing in the Christmas concert? It's great. And then you get a little paycheck for, you know, and there's shorter runs as well. So it's really great. Say if you don't have any work in the summer, you can go to one of these regional theaters and they have these amazing summer programs, and you'll go and stay out there for the summer. Ogunquit up in Maine is a very, very, there's a number of very, very respected, very prestigious regional houses. Because America's, I explain it to Americans because they always ask me, you know, how does touring work in, how does the theatre industry work in Australia? And, you know, we have a big expanse in the middle, but there aren't many people in the middle. Whereas America is very heavily populated all across. I mean, certain deserts and mountains and things to varying degrees, but most towns have a regional theatre. And that's how you're able to sustain a show touring for 2, 3, 4, multiple years. You know, things like Wicked, Hamilton, Lion King have multiple companies touring at the same time. So, yeah, it's very different.
It must be exciting seeing a whole range of houses as well around the country, yeah.
And you tend to play bigger houses on tour because your Broadway houses are surprisingly much smaller than people think. I don't know what the capacity of the World to Occur is. I think it's 11, but it feels like it's in around the 1,100 mark. I think the capital in Sydney is, what, 2,000 or something like that?
Yeah.
And so a lot of the houses that you'd play on tour would be some of these big, some not so big, depending on the size of the town. Some were more intimate than others, but the majority of the houses that we'd play on tour would be much bigger. So that's also a very interesting experience, especially with a show like Come From Away, which is so intimate, to be playing this huge, expansive, cavernous space and try and make the storytelling as intimate and personal as if you were an 1,100-seat theatre. It requires, that is a skill in itself as well, to adapt your performance to the house that you've got. It's I'm very grateful for my touring experience.
Do you enjoy the touring life?
Touring is fantastic. If you are a single person without a rent check to pay, it's great. I did enjoy it. My first tour was Kinky Boots and I absolutely loved it. I got paid to see the country. There were towns that I went to that I did not realize that I would never have chosen to go on vacation, for example. Like Memphis is not necessarily a town that I would have chosen to go. It's one of my favorite American cities now. Seattle is another city that I heard a lot about, but was like, I don't really need to go to Seattle, but absolutely fell in love with it. So it's a really great way. I think I've been to 45 of the 50 now.
Wow.
44 in the 3 tours that I've done. For someone, I'd first moved to the States, it was fantastic. I loved it. I had such a brilliant experience. The second two were a bit rougher because by that stage I'd met my now husband. So Les Mis, I think I booked Les Mis months into us dating. And so that was a little bit tougher. And then with Come From Away, we actually got married while I was on tour. We had booked our wedding for the year while I was on tour. So I went off and got married 2 months, I think, after joining the tour. But I will say what made Come From Away, I think, much more pleasant experience touring was I actually drove the tour. I have our car. And so I would drive myself from city to city. And that made a huge, huge difference, you know, being in charge of my own travel, because it's rough. I mean, you're changing cities every week. You're living in hotel rooms. But there are certain things that you can do to, A, save money, and, B, make it a much more livable experience. And that was the benefit of having done a tour already, was it was like, oh, okay, now I know how to do it smartly. But, you know, I mean, my little car got me through mountains and desert and swamps and all sorts. And we had a lot of adventures together.
Now, I have to ask you a question about Priscilla.
Yes.
You know, actors are put into all sorts of positions and required to do all sorts of things. What was it like being strung up as one of the divas? Because your entrance would be from the flies. You're obviously not scared of heights.
I wasn't then. Now, I like to say that I have a healthy respect for heights now. Talk about dreams. To descend from the ceiling singing the opening notes of what would go on to be probably the most successful or most famous Australian musical of all time. I think between Boy from Oz and I don't know which you would say, but you know, it was incredible. I eventually would get so comfortable up there because I was the first one up, because I was in the middle the most often. I would have little naps up there. I'd be hanging and having little sleeps because we'd be up there for, you know, 10 to 15 minutes, maybe not so long. But it was amazing. I always used to say, though, it would give me an incredible bird's eye view because audiences don't understand. We can see you, especially when you're, you know, at what we say, I'm trying to, now I've been here so long, I'm converting, what, 15 meters up in the air. You can see everything. And so I would, but I would always spot the cameras, which back in the days, so it was digital cameras and they'd have the little light, I would spot them. And, but yeah, you can absolutely see everything, but it was glorious. I am so grateful. That show, I would not be here in America without that show. That show, sorry, it's like a little lump in my throat again. That show gave me put me on the path, truly. And yeah, it was fun. I liked flying. I enjoyed it. Although when I got to doing it in the UK, it was a completely different system of getting us up there, which was, I would probably say a little more scary, because we would walk out from this platform and they would slot us out one by one horizontally. And that was a little more, whereas with the original production, we would just come up from the floor, which I liked a little more. I think it felt a little bit safer.
The great musical, A Chorus Line, features the song What I Did for Love. Now, it's been performed many times and people often sing it as a love song to another person. But of course, it's a song about the sacrifices that an artist makes in pursuing their art. You know, so some of the lyrics, the gift was ours to borrow. Point me toward tomorrow. We did what we had to do. Won't forget, can't regret what I did for love. Ambition, determination, belief, hunger, never losing sight of the end goal. That's exactly what you've done, Amelia Cormack.
Oh, you'll make me. I'm feeling a little, as they say, I'm a little verklempt today, a little emotional today. I guess
have you missed out on much, I guess, by having that end goal in sight?
I've definitely missed time with my family, and you know, having the closeness with my nieces and nephews that I grew up with my cousins, and we were spending time with each other all the time. That's been really hard. You know, I have two nieces, my sister, my mum, most of my family still live in Australia. I'm very fortunate. I have a brother in Rhode Island, which is about 3.5 hours away. So I get to see them a little more regularly, which makes it a lot easier. But it is hard. I'm just so lucky and grateful to have family that support me and support what I'm doing. And I think that's part of the reason why having both of my parents, my dad was opening night and my mum came later to see Hadestown and kind of be able to go, see, this is why I went through all of that. This is why I did it. And you could see them going, we understand, we see it. And I will say I think I've come at a really good time for female identifying people of my age. And older, because the role, when I remember when I turned 30 in 2010, and part of the reason I left was just because there wasn't anything really at that time. There were no roles for women that were over 30. And I just was like, I know I can do more than this. I know I have more to give. And I have this dream of Broadway, and if I don't go now, it won't happen. It was coming back to circling back to what we were talking about before. It was a big risk, but I just went, if I don't go now, I'll never know. And I think, you know, that was the big push. It was like, it may work, it may not. I may not be good enough, but at least I gave it a try. And I think I would rather live with having tried than the regret of never having tried. And, you know, I mean, it's interesting you bring up that song and that show, because that show was such a I always joke that there are certain roles in alternate universes where I am like a very fierce dancer that can kick my face. I would give anything to be in that show and sing that song. But that is why we do it, is because we love it. And it's when I look out into the audience every night and I see the shining faces looking up, and especially a show like this that is, you know, has really touched, I think, a lot of younger people in particular. Like, it's just such a beautiful story, and the music is so wonderful, that are having the same experience I did when I sat in that chair and watched that show. And just because I'm older than them doesn't mean that it was a different, I still was feeling that magic, and it's so incredibly special. And I think it is this, that thing, it's amazing to be telling a Greek myth which is thousands and thousands of years old, and we are channeling something that is as ancient, and an art form that is as ancient as the story is. People coming to see this story now, the same people had the experience sitting in the theater thousands of years ago. And at the end of the show, we sing I Raise My Cup, which is an offering to Orpheus, wherever he is in the world. And there's something that just feels so ancient and timeless about that. And that it's the same experience thousands of years later. The trappings may have changed, but it's the same thing. And that's why we do it, to commune with something that is bigger and better in human nature than us. I don't know. That's very, very hippy dip, very spiritual hippy dippy, but yeah.
No, it's a lovely, lovely way to finish this conversation, Amelia. We can see you at the Walter Kerr Theatre in New York City. Hadestown is currently booking through till May next year. So looks like you're in for a great ride.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's wonderful seeing you achieve your dreams, Amelia. More strength to you, and continued triumph. And thank you for joining us on Stages and having this conversation today.
Thank you so much for having me. So good to see you. And if people want to get in touch on social media, I'm just at Amelia Cormack, and I'm happy to, I always love chatting with people. So come find me, have a chat.
And indeed, if you're in New York City, please go along and see Hadestown. Thanks, Amelia.
Thank you.
Following two intertwining love stories, that of young dreamers Orpheus and Eurydice, and that of King Hades and his wife Persephone, Hadestown invites audiences on a hell-raising journey to the underworld and back. Hadestown marks the first time in over a decade that a woman has been the solo author of a musical, writing the music, lyrics, and book, and is the fourth time in Broadway history a woman has accomplished this creative feat. It also marks the first time in Broadway history that a show's female composer and female director both won Tony Awards for their work. Tickets for Hadestown at the Walter Kerr Theatre are available through to Sunday, May 28th, 2023. If you happen to be in New York, embrace the delights of Broadway, especially Hadestown, and say hello to Amelia. Thanks for joining us in this episode. It is always a joy to have your company. I'm Peter Eyers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.